Well, we are studying the parables in this particular class, and specifically we're studying, well, we have studied not just the parables of Jesus, but also some parables from the Old Testament, but focusing specifically on the parables of Jesus.
Focus specifically.
And so we're going to let Peggy give us a little synopsis of everything we've studied so far.
Amen.
That's right. That's what I used to do when I was in kids' class. You know, any question that was asked, I'd just shoot my hand up and say, Jesus. Yeah, exactly. So that might work here, too, by the way, even if you're an adult. We're going to be studying this morning, let me just say specifically to start off is that we're approaching the parables from the standpoint of seeing what the primary truth behind the parable is, and not trying to make application of every small detail within the parable, because as we've discussed weeks before, sometimes you can get into real trouble with trying to draw your theology from every fine point within the parable, because it simply breaks down, and Jesus did not intend that to be, I don't think, because the point of the parables is to use an everyday story to more or less cast a shadow of the truth that particular story is trying to tell. So therefore, if you put it under too fine a microscope, things tend to kind of break down. As an example, just from a historical standpoint, one guy back in the Middle Ages tried to use the parable of the unjust servant to say that it didn't matter what you did all the way up through your whole life. It just mattered at the time of your death, because God was going to say, it's okay that you did all these bad things, and he's going to forgive you. But that was not the intent of that parable, to say that you shouldn't try to outreach to people with the word, because it's not going to really matter up until the time that they die. And that's basically what that gentleman was trying to proclaim. This morning, we're going to be looking at two parables in Luke. And these particular parables are only recorded in Luke. Many of the parables are recorded in both Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But this particular two parables of Jesus are only recorded by Luke. And we're going to begin in chapter 16, and we're going to look at the two parables in this particular chapter. Now he was also saying to the disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager, and this manager was reported to him as squandering his possessions. And he called him and said to him, what is this I hear about you? Give an accounting of your management, for you can no longer be manager. The manager said to himself, what shall I do, since my master is taking the management away from me? I am not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I shall do, so that when I am removed from the management, people will welcome me into their homes. And he summoned each one of his master's debtors, and he began saying to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he said, 100 measures of oil. 100 measures of oil. Lost my place. And he said to him, take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then he said to another, how much do you owe? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, take your bill and write 80. And his master praised the unrighteous manager because he had acted shrewdly, for the sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind than the sons of light. And I say to you, make friends with yourselves by means of the wealth of unrighteousness, so that when it fails, they will receive you into the eternal dwellings. Okay, let's stop right there, and we're going to finish reading that particular more of the response that Jesus gives to this. Now, what is your take on this particular parable? Does anybody have trouble with this particular parable?
Doing it or reading it?
Well, either one, I guess.
Doing it, yeah.
Okay. This, of all the parables that Jesus gave, is probably the one that has been more open to misinterpretation and has been more open to different interpretations from different people. I mean, you can read 8 commentaries and you get 8 different interpretations of this particular parable. And I guess the real question is, exactly what is Jesus trying to say? What is the truth of this parable that Jesus is trying to get across? Let's just open that up. What do you see in this parable when you read this as being the truth? Anybody else?
I think there's something in the news like that kind of relates to this. Congress is changing the bankruptcy laws. And this is a form of bankruptcy. One of the very first ones of handling. I assume these people can't pay their debt off. So it's a way of reducing the debt and making it more payable than they would have otherwise.
Right.
So really, it's kind of like the beginning of the bankruptcy code, yeah. Year 2000. So it's very practical.
Right.
Makes a lot of sense. You do, and that parable was saying, hey, use some creativity in the world.
Yeah.
And get what you can as a businessman, rather than getting nothing, and then use that also in this curve.
Yeah. And that's, I think, is one of the main points of this parable, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more. But from your standpoint, put yourself in the mind and in the shoes of this manager here. What was the things that he did right, and what were the things that he did wrong? Well, let's start with what were the things that this manager did wrong. Why is he being called into account by his master for the things that he's done? Yeah. In some ways, this parable is not any different from the parable of the talents, in that the Lord has given, in the parable of the talents, he gave to one five, to the other one two, and to the other one. And the five made other five, and the two made other two, and the one took it and buried it in the ground. So in some ways, this is also being addressed very much to that one who took the one talent and threw it in the ground and said, I want to be able to give it back to you because I was afraid I'd lose it. And so, in one way, Jesus is talking about using the things which the Lord has given us. And sometimes I think we overlook the fact that the Lord is expecting us to use things that the world sees as unrighteous, or that may often look to be unrighteous. And he's expecting us to use those in the same way that maybe some of the talents from the standpoint of highlights that we have of ourselves, things that we do well, but he's expecting us to use all of those in very much the same way. Now, where this parable comes, I went back and I was looking through Luke, and it's amazing at the presence of the Pharisees at all of Jesus' teachings. First of all, if you go back to chapter 14, in the beginning of chapter 14, it says that it happened that when he went into the house of one of the leaders of the Pharisee on the Sabbath to eat bread, they were watching him closely. So, he had relations with these Pharisees and the scribes, who most scholars say are basically the Sadducees. So those were the two sects at the time. So Jesus had very close relations with the Pharisees, even though most of them didn't do the things that he was teaching, but they were looking at him. And he gave these parables in chapter 14. He comes on over, and the Pharisees are in the beginning of chapter 15 when he starts a set of parables there as well. He said, both the Pharisees and the scribes, the Sadducees, began to grumble. This is 15, chapter 15, verse 2, saying, this man receives sinners and eats with them. So he was very much under the microscope of what he was teaching, and not only what he was teaching, but his actions as well with the Pharisees, the main people at the time who were most attracted in some ways to the things that he was saying, because the Sadducees didn't believe in the resurrection, so they weren't attracted to him at all. In fact, the Sadducees are the ones that were in power at this time. They were the high priest. They were the leading council there, and they're the ones who Jesus was brought before, who said, put him to death. It was not the Pharisees that did that, although the Pharisees may have stirred him up. But he's very much teaching not only to his own disciples but also to the Pharisees, because even though it says he was also saying to his disciples in the beginning of verse 16, I think he's addressing both his disciples as well as his Pharisees. And in fact, some scholars have said that Jesus is basically giving a parable about the Pharisees, and he's giving a parable about to the Pharisees about the way that they've handled the truths that God has given them. Very much saying that the Master is God, and I don't believe this personally, just to tell you, but I'm just telling you what some of the scholars are saying. Some of the scholars are saying that the Master is God, and that this person who is a bad manager are the Pharisees, because they've had the truths of God. And you look back into chapter 5 of Matthew, and Jesus is talking about divorce. Well, the Pharisees basically were the reason that divorce was in such a situation that it was, because Jesus said it was not to be so from the first. They said, well, Moses allowed us to get a divorce if we didn't like a woman. And the Pharisees basically said, well, yeah, we'll allow you to do that. So they're the one who were writing the decrees of divorce for people against the will of God and against His law. And so a lot of people are saying that they're the ones who are mismanaging. And, you know, it does fit in many cases. For this particular situation, let's talk about, first of all, do you think that, I know Ben has told us about the foreclosure, and I think that he's got a good point here. Do you think that the manager in this particular case did wrong by writing the debt down that these people owed his master? Okay, you think?
Although that may have been, as manager, that may have been his right to manage it. Mm-hmm.
You know, the master wasn't upset by that, was he? He commended him, yeah. He actually commended him for it. Now, let's talk a little bit about the situation here. In Deuteronomy, in chapter 23, verse 19, God made it very specific in the law that He says, you do not charge one another interest if you loan them something. If I had a fellow Jew, and I was back in Jesus' time, I was a nobleman, and I had a fellow Jew, even if he was a common laborer and he wanted to use some of my land, then I could get a portion from him, but I could not loan him money and then charge him interest, because all he had to pay me back was money that I had given him. There was no interest charged. And that was and the law was written that way so that people would have glory in heaven for helping people out rather than glory on earth and from making profit. So, but the common practice at this particular time was that if you were a Jew and you went to a nobleman and asked him for money, he would say, I'm not going to charge you interest, but you want 50 pecks of oil. When you come to pay me back, just give me 100. We're not going to charge interest, but I want you to give me 100. When you do. And that was a very common thing. So that's the way they got around the law. They said, no, we're not charging interest, but just because of inflation, the 50 pecks have gone up to 100 measures of oil. You want this wheat, you can grow this wheat, and you can go sell it, but it's really my wheat, and I'm giving this to you as a loan. But in this particular case, you really harvest 80 measures of wheat. After you sell it, I want you to pay me for 100 measures of wheat. That was the common practice. And so that could have been what was going on here at this particular point, was that this common practice at this particular time was being instituted by this manager. And he was saying, and the master may not have known this, and he may have been saying, to protect my master of the maybe the bad debts that I'm not going to get back, I'm going to inflate this bill so much. So the people knew it. The people knew they were only getting 50 measures of oil, but he was charging them 100. The people knew that they had only had 80 measures of wheat, and he was charging them for 100. So how do you think they looked at that manager for having done that, for having inflated that bill? Well, you can see what he was doing. He was trying to endear himself to the debtors by saying, we're going to follow the law exactly. And, you know, you write down 50 for that wheat. You write down 80 for that oil. He said, and then we'll consider it taken. And the master, the reason he was not upset was because that was the original debt in the first place. Now that may have been what was going on here. It may have been the reason that the master wasn't upset and actually commended the servant for what he did. Now the problem that I have with the manager is that he had skills in this area. Obviously, he had skills in this area. But he did not use the skills that God had given him here. And when it came that the Lord was going to call him, the master was going to call him to give account for the things that had been given to him, his response was not to throw himself before the master and say, "Master, I have sinned. Please give me another chance and I will make this right." But he said in his own mind, "I'm going to go and I'm going to take care of this for these people so that when I get kicked out of here, maybe I got another job over here, you know. So maybe I can endear myself to these people." So that's the problem I have with this particular parable, is that there seemed to be no remorse within the manager himself, but he seemed to be doing everything for his own good. Now, I don't know how far to take that, and I don't know what to do with that, to tell you the truth. I mean, I'm right at this point, so I don't have a lot of answers on this. But I think that Jesus gives us exactly what he's talking about. Well, let's just stop there and say, do you have any comments on that or any questions?
I just want to add to what you said. Why didn't that person use his gifts in his position to glorify God in the first place? He had to wait until there was pressure put on him, and he was put in a corner before he used his talent. And it's like, why don't we use our talents right now in thanksgiving to God before we feel a guilt, motivation,
whatever.
Right.
Well,
it's a good question.
Yeah.
He was entirely selfish oriented. And yet his master still benefited from the use of that selfish motivation.
Right.
His master, instead of writing it off, I just lost, you know, 100, maybe 300, whatever more, was actually able to give maybe his investment back into it. And so that appears to be all he was happy about. This parable is always complete. I never have been able to explain all he could. That does at least explain a part of it. Mm-hmm. But there seems to be no accounting for the fact that the guy was entirely self-centered in this transaction.
Right. And in some ways, the master was self-centered as well. Because, I mean, why was he happy? Was he happy that his man had turned around and done something good? No, I think he was happy because he got some money out of it, that he got a return on it. So that's the reason I have a hard time saying that the master is God, you know, because I don't think God would react completely like that. So
one element, I guess, is, you know, I talked about this, but it is about, at some level, there is that element that says, you know, there's something in here for me. Mm-hmm. You know, and here he promotes his wisdom and being prudent, kind of real self-centeredness. And I'm kind of shooting from the hip here, but there is that element of faith that, okay, you know, some bottom line, you know, helps me out.
Yeah.
Not dying yourself.
Right. Yeah, in fact, and that one word that you said, his master committed him for being prudent, some translations translate that wisely, but in reading a couple of commentators on that particular word, they say that the better translation is prudence, not wisdom, because it appears that the master is not praising him for his great wisdom, but for his prudence and at least getting him something back for the debt that he had. Mine says squandering too.
Mm-hmm. That makes it even more confusing in my mind. It seems like what he's doing is more squandering.
How
is he squandering possessions?
Well, it's a possibility that he was embezzling money from him. It was a possibility that he was taking it's a possibility he'd been doing this all along and had actually gotten 100 measures of wheat and had taken 50 for himself. I mean, so in some ways, I mean, we don't have a lot of details as to exactly what he had been doing, of course, for this parable, but I think, and if you try to delve into that too much, I mean, it's only speculation as to what he might have been doing. But the point was, he was not managing his master's possessions as he should. Okay, let's read starting in verse 10. Okay, well, let's start back up at verse 9. And I say to you, make friends for yourselves by means of the wealth of unrighteousness, so that when it fails, they will receive you into the eternal dwellings. He who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much. And he who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. Therefore, if you have not been faithful in the use of righteous wealth, who will entrust the true riches to you? And if you have not been faithful in the use of that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. Okay, now what does Jesus say there? Jesus is telling us the reason that he told that parable. What's he saying to us about unrighteous wealth? What's he saying to us about... And again, this is one of the reasons I think he's directing a lot of this to the Pharisee, because these were a bunch of fishermen. I mean, they didn't settle debts as far as, you know, of having land to sell and wheat to sell and oil to sell.
I think sometimes we think of it as people who are quote wealthy, when, I mean, I think the fisherman, just as weakly as a wealthy person, said he had five fish instead of whatever in the bucket. I mean, I think that's when he talks about, if you're not faithful with the little things, you know, why are you going to be faithful with bigger things? And I think that's the same with me. You know, I think, you know, well, when I get out of debt, I'm really going to be able to give a lot. Or when I, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm not doing it now, I'm not going to do it then. Because I'm still serving that master,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is money, and trying to figure out how to maneuver it.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, I think it can go to fishermen, even though maybe Private Parable was talking more to the other. I think, well, I should sure be listening to it.
Yeah.
Because that being righteous with, you know, with that...
Yeah. And I think what Jesus is saying here is that you have a life in the Father, and you remember how we talked about the kingdom of heaven parables, about how that was the kingdom of heaven was actually Christ living in you, that it wasn't necessarily just the church, that it was Christ living in you. And I think what Jesus is saying here, he's saying, in some ways I think he's saying, just because you have me living in you now, and of course that wasn't that way at this particular time, because Jesus had to die on the cross and for that to happen to us, for us, and baptism and things like that. But I think that he's saying, just because I'm living inside of you doesn't mean that you all of a sudden become ignorant of material things within the world. And because, you know, I think we have some servants of Satan who are very, very good managers of material things within the world. But I think what Jesus is saying is that when I live in your life, that everything that is around you and comes into contact with you is something that you must be accountable for at some time, because it's a part of your life, and so therefore your management of that particular area is going to have to be something that you're drawn into account for at some time. I think that's what he's saying here. He's saying that you need to use unrighteous wealth and unrighteous things in the world that we may consider unrighteous. He says you still need to pay all your bills. You still need to be you still need to go, and when you have long distance carriers, you need to find out which one's the cheapest and take that one instead of using AT&T all the time. I mean, I'm just using myself as an example there. You need to go and see what Sprint will give you and what MCI will give you and what AT&T will give you. And then you need to do that because everything that I've given you is mine, and I want you to be wise with it. And so therefore, I don't want the people that are serving Satan to be more wise in the use of personal things than you are. That's what he says, because if you won't be righteous over things that are small, if you say, oh, I'm not of that, so therefore I don't need to even worry about that. And then you just get taken to the cleaners by everybody that you have dealings with in the world, I think God's going to call you into account for that. And I think what Jesus is saying, he's saying, don't serve wealth, but, you know, if you have it, use it for my glory. I think that's what he's saying with this parable. He's saying, if you have it, don't just lose your brain because I'm living inside of you, but do the things which are right to make it be so that people can still point to you and say, hey, there's a rich man, and he still loves people, and he still does things with his money so that gives glory to God. I think that's what Jesus is saying.
Isn't that impressive?
Yes, yes.
I mean, when we see somebody that's really doing that, loving God so much and has lots of money, it's impressive.
Yeah. Now, the next parable, we'll get to that in a minute, but the next parable is about a rich man and a poor man, and they both die, and one goes to Abraham's bosom as if that is the ultimate place. But you know who Abraham was? He's probably one of the richest men out of his nation in his particular time. He had everything. God had blessed him with so much, and he had everything. And yet, he would be the wise steward, I would classify, of using earthly wealth to promote the Lord in his life. And you remember when the angels came up to him? That were going to Sodom and Gomorrah to destroy it. How did he receive them? Did he say, "Oh, I'm too wealthy to mess with these nomads coming through here"? No, he took them in. He killed the calf. He fed them. He took care of their needs. He did that. He didn't let his wealth come in the way of him doing what God's will was in his own life. So I think that's what Jesus is saying here. Any comments? Questions? Okay, let's look at verse 14. Now the Pharisees, who were the lovers of money, and that's an important point there of what he's saying, because you're going to see that with this next parable, were listening to all of these things and were scoffing at him. And I don't know why they were scoffing at him, but because I would think the things that he was saying would have been kind of appealing to him, because they were so much on the law and doing everything, and yet they kind of went around and did things behind on the law around the other way. And he said to them, "You are those who justify yourselves in the sight of men, but God knows your hearts. For that which is highly esteemed among men is detestable in the sight of God. The law and the prophets were proclaimed until John. Since that time, the gospel of the kingdom of God has been preached, and everyone is forcing his way into it. But it is easier for heaven and earth to pass away than for one stroke of a letter of the law to fail. Everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery, and he who marries one who is divorced from a husband commits adultery." Now, where did verse 18 come from? That's a good question, because it seems like it's almost pulled out of somewhere else and stuck in here. And I'm not so sure that that's not what Luke did, because some scholars say that this particular verse was a result of the Pharisee or of them coming to him and saying, "Can we write a decree of divorce for my wife, because Moses let us do it," and some think that it's that. But I think he's in his address to the Pharisees is that he's addressing their scoffing at him in this and saying, and he's talking about what's gonna come. He says, And he talks about the truth of the law and how true it is there in verse 17. But he's talking about coming into the kingdom when John the Baptist came, about this message of repentance that he had. And it seems like that he kind of uses this to lead into this next parable. He says, and let's read that. Now there was a rich man, and he habitually dressed in purple and fine linen, joyously living in splendor every day. And a poor man named Lazarus was laid at his gate, covered with sores, and longing to be fed with the crumbs which were falling from the rich man's table. Besides, even the dogs were coming and licking his sores. Now the poor man died and was carried away by the angels to Abraham's bosom, and the rich man also died and was buried. In Hades he lifted up his eyes, being in torment, and saw Abraham far away and Lazarus in his bosom. And he cried out and said, Father Abraham, have mercy on me and send Lazarus so that he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool off my tongue, for I am in agony in this flame. But Abraham said, Child, remember that during your life you received your good things, and likewise Lazarus bad things. But now he is being comforted here, and you are in agony. And besides all of this, between us and you, there is a great chasm fixed, so that those who wish to come over from here to you will not be able, and that none may cross over from there to us. And he said, Then I beg you, Father, that you send him to my father's house, for I have five brothers, in order that he may warn them, so that they will not also come to this place of torment. But Abraham said, They have Moses and the prophets, let them hear them. But he said, No, Father Abraham, but if someone comes to them from the dead, they will repent. But he said to him, If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be persuaded, even if someone rises from the dead. Okay, is this a parable or is this a true story?
Yes.
is this a parable laid out specifically to tell us what's going to happen to us after we die? No, I don't either. What do we know about the rich man and Lazarus? What do we know about them from this parable?
Very little.
Very, very little. Why do we think that the rich man was bad and that Lazarus was good? Were all men who were poor and beggars and laid at the gate with sores all over them, were they always righteous? No, but...
We know that rich man's been ignored. Yeah.
Uh-huh, yeah. That's a good point, yeah. He did... Right. Yeah, we're not given anything as to their deeds or what they did or whether they were right or wrong. I mean, Jesus doesn't lay that out for us at all. He doesn't say the rich man, I mean, he says he was wealthy, but he doesn't say, and he never considered his fellow man. He cheated people. He did this. He broke these commandments. He doesn't tell us anything about what the rich man did wrong. As he doesn't tell us why that Lazarus was so good that when he died, the angels came and took him away. we have to assume that one was bad and one was good just because of the settings that Jesus puts them into, not because of specific deeds that they were done. Now, we know, what we do know is that this rich man was a very rich man, because when he said, and my version translates this, and I think this is the correct translation, he habitually dressed in purple. In other words, you couldn't see him at any time when he didn't have purple on. I guess he wore purple pajamas to bed, probably, or something. He habitually dressed in purple. In other words, he wouldn't accept anything less. I mean, it's kind of like me only wanting brand name clothes and never wearing just Kmart jeans, I guess you could say. And we don't put a lot of maybe stock in the fact that it was purple and that it was fine linen, but the purple was in some cultures at this time were reserved strictly for nobility, and others, and also strictly for someone who was the king or a governor who was of that lineage. I mean, you couldn't wear purple if you were a common man. And you wouldn't wear it because it was so expensive. They made it so expensive that only those people could afford it. So this was not just a rich man, but a very, very rich man with high status within his society.
So, I was just thinking of Lydia, who was a seller of purple. Right. Obviously, she was a good businesswoman, and that was a very successful operation.
Yeah, she was like the Rolls Royce salesman of this year, this time, because she only dealt in the best and things. Now, as opposed to Lazarus, he had nothing. And in fact, he couldn't even get inside the gates. I mean, it was almost as if he was a leper. And I don't know, maybe he was a leper. Maybe that's what these sores were, because they did have external sores when they had leprosy. We're not going to get through this. But the fact that he was laid at the gate of the rich man's property may have been, I mean, the people who knew him and loved him maybe did that simply so that this rich man would be able to see him, because they knew that this was the one person that could maybe help him or take care of him. But that's only speculation, but that's a possibility. But he wasn't allowed in a lot of the places that the rich man was, and he was probably one of the most destitute people in this particular situation here. Now, so bad that the rich man had all of these attendants to come to him and to take care of his needs. Lazarus only had the dogs to come and lick his sores, which I don't know if that was good or bad. maybe that was a relief to him in some ways. But that's the only person who he had to come to attend to him was the dogs. So I think that kind of reflects more his situation. Now, it's interesting, the word Lazarus as well, because, of course, Luke was written by a doctor, and this was a common medical term back in that particular time. Lazarus was from the root word, which was a common medical term, and one scholar said, and I didn't get to confirm this, but one scholar said it actually meant sores, is what it meant. So, I mean, and now we know that Jesus had a friend whose name was Lazarus, a different Lazarus from this. I don't know if he gave him, if Luke gave him this name, or if the Lord actually spoke his name. I would think that the Lord actually spoke his name, or gave him this name. But it was kind of like if you made up a story yourself and you called a person in there who was probably the person down on their luck, you would call him destitute or something. And destitute said this, or destitute said that. So it would be more like this name was a reference to his situation, not just a name that was given to him by his mother necessarily. Okay, now they both died, and one was carried away by angels into Abram's bosom. Now, let's talk about Abram's bosom. Do we find that anywhere else in the Bible? No, we do not. Where does that particular term come from? The term Abraham's bosom and the term paradise were both... Now, paradise we do have, because Jesus said to the thief on the cross, "This day you will be in paradise." They are both references to a place that the souls of righteous people go before judgment. It's kind of the intermediate place between heaven and earth. And that's kind of the waiting place. Both of those places are mentioned as a way. The Abraham's bosom is mentioned and is talked about in the Talmud, I believe it is. It's a book of Jewish beliefs, I guess you could say. It's not really an inspired book, but it's mentioned in the Talmud. It was around in Jesus' time as being the place, one of these places. The Talmud mentions both paradise and Abraham's bosom. And both are referred to in the same way as a resting place where relief can be and also where the souls of righteous people. Now Hades is also mentioned as a resting place for those who are going to be judged and who have not followed God. So, I mean, I don't want to get into that because, I mean, that suggests to me that why do you have judgment then? Because everybody's already into one place or the other, so you kind of know from the time that you die where you're going to be. But I don't want, that's not the purpose of this parable, I don't think, so we're not really going to get into that. So, you know, I think this is probably a good place to stop, and since the second bell has just rung, we're probably going to stop. Anybody have a final comment? We'll pick up here next week and finish off the parable of Lazarus and the rich man. But any closing statements?
Just one little comment. It says those last verses aren't a parable. And one of the reasons is that because you know the parable was a person named.
Yeah.
But if you take the name Lazarus, so it's
I had read that and knew from another commentator that this is the only parable where Jesus actually names a person in the parable, but I had not heard that particular one. Okay, well maybe we can talk about that some more next week. Thank you.